thing we have to fear is fear itself. Fear itself. Fear itself.
From the Center for History and New Media at George Mason University, this is Digital Campus, a bi-weekly discussion of how digital media and technology are affecting learning, teaching, and scholarship at colleges, universities, libraries, and museums.
Ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country. Fear itself.
This is Digital Campus number 5 for the 2nd of May, 2007. Tragedy and Technology. I'm Dan Cohen. Welcome to another episode of Digital Campus. I'm here today. My name is Dan Cohen, of course, and I'm here with our regulars, Mills Kelly. Hi, Mills.
Hi, Dan.
And Tom Scheinfeld. Hi, Tom.
Hi, Dan.
And we have a slightly different format today. We're actually just going to talk about the Virginia Tech tragedy. We'll be back next week with our normal format where we start with some news from the past couple of weeks and have a featured story and then toss out some links to our audience. We just thought, given the events of a couple of weeks ago, that it would be a little bit trivial to talk about some of these things. And so we wanted, and we had some things we wanted to say about the tragedy, and in particular the role that technology played on campus, and so we're going to focus on that today. And I just wanted to start with a bit of an editor's note about our recordings. We actually record Digital Campus usually 2 to 3 days ahead of when they're actually released via iTunes and digitalcampus.tv on our blog, and so. Our last podcast number 4, was actually being recorded up, sadly, I think at the same time that the shootings were going on. And, you know, we apologize for any seeming, callousness on our part when it seemed like we had a podcast come out on, you know, these happy things on social networking online a couple of days after the tragedy on April 18th. We released that podcast, but of course we'd already recorded it when that occurred. And so this is our first podcast after April 16th that we've recorded after April 16th. And so we wanted to just sit down and have a roundtable and discuss some of the aspects of the tragedy and, again, the role that technology played in it. And, you know, we wanted to also say at the start that, you know, obviously this was a very troubled person, and, you know, I don't think we have anything really profound to add in terms of, you know, what can one say really about this tragedy. And so, you know, I think we'll, in some sense, you know, dance around perhaps some of the more serious issues. We're not going to talk about gun control or, you know, psychosis or anything like that. But I thought that, you know, one place where we could start off, Tom and Mills, is actually our topic from last week in some ways was germane in that for those who didn't listen to our last podcast, we were talking about the role of social networking sites like MySpace or Facebook on campus and whether they can play a positive role. And I think we really focused on their advantages. And I admitted up front that I don't participate in these social networks. And Mills and Tom, I think, explained some really great ways that they can be integrated into the classroom, into faculty-student relationships, into student-student relationships. And, you know, the first thought that I had after the tragedy at Virginia Tech was, you know, I bet this guy didn't have a MySpace or Facebook account. And I believe that ended up being correct. And I think we probably didn't focus as much as we could have on the downside from, you know, from the student's perspective. And, you know, I just look back at the history of computing. You know, when I was in high school and college in the 1980s, you know, computing actually was the area where all the loners hung out. And I have to admit, you know, I was one of those kind of nerdy people. You know, I think it was a retreat in some sense from the social world. And I think it's very interesting, considering what we discussed last week, to notice that just in the last decade, really, computing has really moved in the mainstream, but also because of the connection of personal computers to the internet, it really is a very social realm. And I think people who don't participate in that realm, I think it's very indicative of, what's going on, mentally. And I think it's an area that I think we often forget about. I think, one of the things that's really difficult probably for a lot of students when they participate in MySpace or Facebook is, these places, they really quantify in a very forward way, how many friends you have and who you're connected to. And, that can be very difficult, I think, for a lot of, I remember when I was younger, to think about how many friends you had or who you had friends with. I mean, to have all that really out there and quantified undoubtedly is probably very difficult for some people. That's my two very, very poor cents on this. Tom, what were your initial thoughts after 2 weeks ago?
Well, I think I had some of the same thoughts as you, Dan. I think the social networking piece of this is interesting. You're really right that the game of social networking, the game of Facebook and MySpace is really to, gather as many friends together as you can and to tell everyone how many friends you have. And it's very easy to fall into that game. And if you don't happen to be terribly good at playing that game, those places can be almost a slap in the face. And I think that's a great point that you make. Another thing that I thought I noticed was that there was sort of an immediate jump to conclusions that this guy must have been a gamer. He must be playing Grand Theft Auto.
Right.
And I think, that is possibly a reasonable assumption in some cases. But in this case, increasingly these games are becoming more and more like social networking sites. And the question is, if he had been a real hardcore gamer and playing World of Warcraft every day and belonged to a guild, which is really a virtual community of fellow gamers, would this same thing have happened? I know, Dr. Phil immediately jumped to the conclusion that he must be playing too many video games. That turns out to be not the case. And
it's a good point about the realm of gaming really becoming a social networking site as well, as opposed to, the early editions of Doom or Quake, where you could actually do it over your local area network. But in many cases, these were really solo play environments, but World of Warcraft certainly isn't.
Well, and my own take on this is just a little different, only because I have sort of two perspectives on it. One is that I grew up next door to somebody who he's a paranoid schizophrenic, and so over the years I've watched just how isolating mental illness can be in our society, both for the person who suffers from the mental illness, but also for their entire family who is trying to cope with the illness. And so I have some understanding in a very, very small way for what this person's family had gone through in terms of, and in addition, being immigrants made it even more difficult. The second perspective that I have is, I have two small children and, a couple of kids in elementary school. And one of the things that I wanted them to understand something worth knowing about this whole experience. And one of the things that I pointed out to both of them was that it was not normal for any child, and anybody under 30 seems like a child to me, sorry, but just because I'm getting old. But any child to not have any friends, zero friends. And it was very clear that this young man had no connection to the community. I mean, not in the suite that he lived in his dorm, not in the high school he attended, not through social networking sites. And he was completely isolated. And I think one of the things that a lot of campus administrators are going to take away from this whole experience is to pay more attention to the students on campus who are completely isolated from the community. And I think, you know, they're not just going to look at the conventional ways of knowing that anymore. The conventional ways were, you know, do you see him hanging out with people in the student union or something like that? Does he get along with his roommate? But also, I think they'll, because social networking has become so ubiquitous, I think that's another question to ask. Does this person participate in the ways that students connect to one another? Because, you know, that's a sign that somebody needs some help. When, right. Not that they, you know, I'm not saying that if they don't have a MySpace page, they need some help. I'm saying that if they are completely isolated from their community around them, then those are indicators that somebody needs to talk to the student and find out a little bit more about what's going on. And, you know, and it's a tremendous challenge on a vast campus like Virginia Tech or like our own campus here at George Mason, where they're, you know, they're small cities. And, you know, Virginia Tech with almost 30,000 people, here with over 30,000 people, it's very hard to for a small staff to do that kind of thing. But I think we will be paying a lot more attention to it. I want to say one other thing about what you guys were saying about the games. I mean, it being social networking opportunities. I already see this with my older son. Last year, the seems like half the fourth grade at my child's elementary school was playing RuneScape, and sort of medieval world where people, you know, trade things and get money and kill goblins and that kind of stuff. But for them, the really important thing was to meet each other in RuneScape on Friday afternoon at 4:30, and, you know, right after they got off the bus. And there would be 10 or 12 boys who would all pal around together in this virtual world, which, you know, to me seemed awfully strange, but just further proof of how old I am.
Yeah. You know, and I think, you know, I think all of us would agree that we're not saying this to, you know, to excuse what happened or to say that, you know, these technologies were responsible. But I think Mills, you put it very well, that I think some of these technologies can and should be used by campus administrators as indicators. You know, I think we just have to follow where students are congregating and what they're doing. And, you know, it's one of the many assessment tools that I think people can have about, you know, whether a student is really having serious trouble, you know, integrating into normal social life. Yes, sorry.
Yeah, and I mean, I think in many ways this is a story about, you know, connection and disconnection, and, you know, in that respect, it is in some ways a story about technology. And one of the stories I think that came up in the media was the question of how Virginia Tech not only connects with, or how a college campus not only connects with these troubled students, but how it connects with the rest of campus when something bad happens. And there was a question of whether email was the best way to get in touch with the students and right after the shootings.
It's a great point.
Again, this idea of connection and disconnection makes it a story about really about information technology.
Right. And I think in that case, sorry, go ahead.
I was just going to say, as you know, as I was reading the media accounts that Tom's talking about, you know, was email the right way to get in touch with the students? I was thinking about what we discussed in one of our first podcasts about, you know, for an awful lot of sort of traditional age college students today, email is a way to get in touch with old people as opposed to being a way to get in touch with each other. And I think we're going to see a lot of looking at text message systems, which could send out, you know, a text message to everyone who subscribes, you know, other ways in addition to email for trying to spread the word about anything in a real hurry.
Right.
I actually took a poll of my students this week to ask them, you know, what's the best way to get in touch with you guys if the administration really needs to get some information out to you. And it was unanimous that text messaging was the way to go. Then the next question I asked them was, well, has anyone on campus ever asked you for your cell phone number? And again, unanimous, the answer was no. So I think it's remarkable that campuses probably don't even have the cell phone numbers for a lot of these kids. They have their email, they have their parents' phone numbers, they maybe have, if they have a landline in their dorm, they have that number, but they don't have this, you know, technology that these students, you know, live with and carry everywhere they go and sleep with. One girl in the class even said, you know, I sleep with it by the bed and you know, it's on at all times, and if it goes off, I answer it. So it's interesting, though, that we as administrators and faculty haven't really caught up with that yet.
Yeah, you know, after 9/11, for those who don't know, George Mason is right outside of Washington, D.C., and, you know, after 9/11, the county I live in Maryland, Montgomery County, which is just above the District of Columbia, initiated a program where you could actually sign up with your cell phone numbers to get text messages in case of an emergency. And, you know, I mostly use this to get traffic reports and things like that if there's an accident. But, you know, it was instituted for precisely this reason, that they felt you can actually get it in multiple ways. You can get it via email, text message, and I think even in some cases get some kind of a call alert to your home or cell phone. So it provides a multi-channel alert system that to me is very impressive and I think important. You know, the downside of this is, you know, again, about Tom, as you put it, the story of feeling connected is that, you know, whenever I get one of these alerts, it kind of brings back the fear of 9/11 and sort of makes it very present. You know, the worry about that we have in Washington that someone's going to set off a dirty bomb or something like that. You know, it's the presentist aspect of this, the feeling of always being kind of ready for an alert or under a warning, I think is something that we haven't really thought through. You know, the effects of that on, you know, just going back to the campus case, suppose we did this on our campus. It does sort of cast a pall in some way of, you know, that we need this. I mean, sadly, perhaps we do need this kind of alert system. And certainly in the Washington area, we probably do. But there is something a little depressing about it that I do worry about. I mean, I worry about, my kids are only three, but, you know, when they're older, giving them a cell phone and saying, hey, you have to sign up for this alert system because something horrible might happen at any moment.
Right.
It's tough for me to swallow.
It is a difficult question of when to deliver these alerts. It's one thing to deliver something to someone's email where they can check it when they want and they can ignore it when they get it. But to when do you send an alert that's delivered to someone's pocket? If let's say every student on campus registered their cell phone number with the university, when would they use that text message service? Would they send out an alert because, you know, there was a fire in some building, you know, on the far end of campus to every student on campus? Does that sort of constitute an emergency? Does that come to the level of sending a text message to every student? When do you use these technologies?
Once they're in place, it's exactly what happened with Montgomery County. I mean, I get alert for everything from a thunderstorm to, you know, an accident that is many miles from me. Montgomery County is a huge county. But everybody gets the same alert, and so it really does put you on edge a little bit. Well, I think, you know, another aspect of, you know, Tom, your point about disconnection and connection, you know, I think one of the wonderful things about technology is the way, I think, over the past 2 weeks, it's really brought not only the Virginia Tech community and the Virginia community and the nation together. You know, it's brought them together online in ways that really weren't possible a few years ago. And at the Center for History and New Media, we've been exploring some of the ways to do this through a couple of our archives. Probably the one that's best known is our September 11th Digital Archive, which is available at 911digitalarchive.org. And more recently, a online memorial archive and site for the hurricanes Rita and Katrina, which is available at hurricanearchive.org. You know, we've been exploring the ways in which we can use websites to collect stories, memorializations, artwork, reactions, email from the day, and sort of, you know, not only in a way to, I think, provide some healing as best we can, but also to leave, a very good record for the future, for future historians, for future researchers, for future students to kind of look back on an event and see all of the positive things, all of the family of Virginia Tech and their response. And so this week we wanted to really point out just one link and talk about it a little bit, which is the April 16th archive, which is available at april16archive.org. Tom, do you want to talk a little bit about where this came out of and the software that's running it?
Sure, sure. You know, as you said, Dan, we've been working on this problem of documenting using the web and online communications technologies to document history as it happens, as it were. And we did that with the September 11th Digital Archive. We've done it again with the Hurricane Archive. And when the Virginia Tech tragedy occurred, some colleagues down at Virginia Tech, in particular a guy named Brent Jessick, gave us a call and said, you know, I know you guys have been working on this problem for a while. We're interested in doing the same something similar. Could you help us out? And in fact, he called it kind of a good moment because we've been at the Center for History and New Media. We've been trying to generalize some of the technologies that we've used to do these projects into a kind of into a software package that would be easily installable to allow for very kind of rapid reaction so that historians and other humanists could very quickly set something up, a digital memory bank, as these events happen in their communities. They could be local events, they could be more regional events, more national events like the Virginia Tech story. Brent called it a good time because we are moving towards releasing a public beta of this sometime this summer. We're calling it Omeka, which is a Swahili word for to share, to discuss, to lay out for discussion. And so we're moving towards releasing a public beta of that. Right now we've got kind of an alpha version of the software, but it was good enough for Brent and his team who have some fairly sophisticated skills to get something up and running very quickly. And it's, you know, when we first launched the 9/11 archive, it took us maybe 3 months to get something up and running. When we launched the Hurricane archive, it took us maybe 3 weeks to get something up and running. We're to the point now where when Brent called, we were able to get something, you know, with our team working on it and his team working on it, get something up and running in about 3 days. So this is becoming more and more possible, and the team down at Virginia Tech is doing a great job and really starting to collect some rich documentary material.
Yeah, and I think you know, one of the points that I wanted to make about you know, this software and sort of where it comes from is that when we did the 9/11 archive, I mean, this was before Flickr, really before blogs took off, and so the practice of self-documenting, of you know, archiving photos or widely sharing photos and thoughts, et cetera, sort of really hadn't come into the mainstream. I mean, it was really in an early adopter phase. And I think now, I think there's a very wide group of people who are interested in doing this. And so we really felt that, you know, the time had come to produce some software that would allow people to do this on their own. Because, Tom, as you mentioned, I think before that, we were sort of doing, I mean, not only us, but other people who wanted to do these kinds of archives, online archives, we're sort of creating ad hoc database-driven applications. And I think this will be a really easy way, I think, you know, much like WordPress, to kind of install something quickly and get something going because, you know, people want to contribute when it's still fresh, when they have things to say, when they feel it's very relevant to their lives. You know, and I would also say, you know, this doesn't have to be used for tragedy. I'd like to see Omeka used for you know, anniversaries, for, you know, positive events, for conferences, for, festrifs, for, you know, for any number of things that might occur on campus or off that people would want, a very thorough record, a visual record, an audio record, a text record of that I think has a lot of people who could contribute to it. And I think it sort of democratizes the archive and makes it very easy to put online.
Yeah, and I would just add that one thing that we've been working on with the Hurricane Archive project here is ways of gathering into an archive like this other material that's posted around on the web in under some sort of Creative Commons license. And so we've developed a plugin already for Omeka that will allow us to pull down every photograph with a certain tag on it. So for the Hurricane Archive, it's anything tagged Hurricane Katrina, and we can pull down all 14,000 plus of those that are with a Creative Commons license in just in the Flickr database and put them into the archive and preserve them. I just did a quick check of what was in Flickr that said April 16th and Virginia Tech, and there are already 235 photographs available. And so it's, you know, for these archives, it's going to be, I think, a mix of material that people put in because they go to the archive and contribute something, but then also for the archivists, finding ways to use the technology to gather things that are digital records that are posted in a variety of locations.
That's a really great point. I mean, I think archivists, you know, those in museums and libraries are faced with a very difficult task. And I think they're well aware of this, as we talk with them all the time. But, you know, I think their job has become much tougher in a world where so many things are born digital rather than physical objects. And you can't do archiving anymore by, you know, relying on what happened with the materials I study from the Victorian era, which, you know, I've read letters that were just saved in shoeboxes and put under someone's bed. Well, you know, you can't rely on that with digital objects. You need to preserve them, get them while they're still there on someone's hard drive, get them into a format, add metadata to them, you know, put them into some silo that then can be preserved for the long run, because you can't just wait 100 years and go underneath someone's bed and find a great cache of letters about what happened during or after an event. You sort of have to get it in the moment. And I think that's where this kind of software will really play an important role in the future. Well, I think, again, we would encourage everyone to go visit the site that Brent's put up. You know, it's just wonderful to hear that it's already collecting a lot of terrific photographs and stories. And I think, you know, hopefully it will play some small role or hopefully some larger role in providing an online location for memorialization and archiving of the event. And hopefully it will be somewhere like the September 11th archive or the Hurricane Archive, where we've seen, you know, every year millions of people come back to these sites on the anniversary of the event and look at what all these individuals have put up. And I think it's a great place for just regular people to participate in the process of archiving, because, you know, there are places already where, you know, official records, the records of what happened to, you know, what politicians did, you know, that stuff is going to be saved. But what individual people did, photos that they took, emails that they wrote, that kind of stuff is in danger of being lost. And I think, you know, it's terrific that in some small way we can sort of help the Virginia Tech community out, you know, with this software to sort of help them set up a site quickly and to save this material from a very wide range of people. So I think, you know, speaking for Tom and Mills, I think, you know, we all encourage people to go visit april16archive.org. And again, we'll be back in 2 weeks with hopefully a happier and a normal format here on Digital Campus.
Thing we have to fear is fear itself. Fear itself. Fear itself.
Please visit us online at digitalcampus.tv, where you can join in the discussion and let us know about stories and issues you would like us to cover on future episodes. Mike O'Malley wrote our theme music.
Not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country. Fear itself.